Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
There was an article written June 8th in Rolling Stone called The Sudden Lucrative Gold Rush for Old Music. Catalog sales, biopics, holograms, and other media are extending the lifespan and sometimes enormously expanding the value of rock's classic brands. And that's where you come in. Can you describe what it is that you do?
I started this company about 21 years ago with my then partner, Danny Sugarman, who sadly passed away in 2005. And Danny had worked for the Doors since he was 12 and a half years old, and famously co-authored the book No One Here Gets Out Alive, which mm-hmm. is the story of the Doors. And when Danny and I partnered up to co-manage the Doors, you know, we really were looking at it with fresh eyes and a whole new approach, which is that these classic artists are, it's kind of like managing a pop culture legacy, if you will.
Yeah.
And, you know, I also teach at UCLA. And one of the things that I teach my students in the first week is, I said, you know, successful artists have magic and they have alchemy. And there is something that connects a 12-year-old to Janis Joplin or Jim Morrison or Jimi Hendrix. And if you think it's about the music, you're going to fail my class. Because if you think it's about the music, then by deductive logic and reasoning, you also think the magic to James Dean is about his acting. It's an entry point, but it's not the thing.
Can I ask you what the name of this course is?
I teach several different courses, one of which is called The Music Business Now, which is one of the required courses for their music industry and history degree, undergraduate degree at UCLA.
Wow. Where was that when I was in school? God, I'd love to take that.
Right?
Yeah. So, you know, I also watch the artist catalogs, which we can get to in just a second, but the first thing that popped into my mind was Taylor Swift, who right. had her, if I understand this correctly, the rights to all of her music were controlled by somebody else, and she couldn't get it back, so she went into a recording studio and basically re-recorded everything
correct.
To a certain extent so that she could control it. And artists having control of their publishing was something I think that they became more aware of as time went on, because, you know, these rock stars would come on in the 60s and they'd have some hits, and they were really young kids at the time and maybe didn't realize the legal ramifications and the long-term importance of owning the publishing rights, because there was such a monetary aspect to it. But obviously you realized that early on.
Well, I think that it all came out of the 50s when rock and roll first started, and a lot of the executives treated artists like third or fourth class citizens.
Exactly.
Below second class.
Yes.
It's like, hey kid, here's a Cadillac, go away.
Right, yeah. Right. And the kid is like, oh, gee, thanks. And
right.
Look at Buddy Holly. I mean, yeah. Here we are, I don't know how many decades later, and I believe there's a Buddy Holly, certainly Buddy Holly music is still prevalent, and I think there's a Buddy Holly hologram, which is a mind-blowing thing as far as I'm concerned.
That's a whole other topic. We should talk about.
Yeah, I know. But it's still mind-boggling. And,
yeah.
and in many instances, I mean, we were all around when, you know, Michael Jackson passes away or Elvis passes away. And when that happens, it seems like the sales of their music skyrockets.
Well, always. Anytime anything happens that calls attention to an artist, then a lot of eyes and ears will be focused on that artist. And it's a blip. It's temporary, but it happens in pop culture.
And, you know, you've worked a lot on expanding these artists' legacies just beyond their music catalogs. You've been involved in award-winning films and musicals. You must obviously think that those avenues add to an artist's reach beyond their initial period of influence.
Sure. And here, I'll explain it to you this way. Let's reverse it for a minute, okay?
Sure.
So we look at what the magic is of the artist. You know, there's, again, there's something special that connects that artist. You know, one of the examples I always use is that Pat Boone had a lot more gold records and hit singles than Jim Morrison ever did. So if it's about the music, why are 12-year-olds not cleaving to Pat Boone?
Very good point.
And the thing is, we already know. We know what happened. We know what happened in 67 and 77 with Janis, with Jim Morrison, with whomever. And the idea is, I've always said that, you know, managing or owning a pop culture legacy is like walking up a down escalator. Because with the time that marches on in pop culture, if you're standing still, you're not standing still, you're moving backward.
Oh, absolutely.
And one of the things that I realized, with a lot of shock, I got to tell you, is that some of our American icons have gone so far down the escalator that they've actually fallen off. And once they fall off, it takes so many thousands of hours and so many hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to get them back just on the second or third bottom step that I don't think it'll ever be done. Think about iconic names. Think about Bing Crosby, Bob Hope, Jackie Gleason. They're gone. What 14-year-old is going to feel any relevance to Bob Hope?
I get your point.
And so I want to make sure that doesn't happen to my clients, to any pop culture legacy, because it's about the art and the message. And I think art is important, and the messages are critical, and I think art saves lives. And so the idea is that whatever that magic is, the idea for us is to take that thing and that discussion and put it back in the pop culture discussion today in a way that's meaningful and credible and authentic to an 11 to 30-year-old.
Jeff, the idea of representing an artist who is no longer with us brings in, to me anyway, the rights to the publishing, the family, the estate. How does all that work? That's a balancing act for you, isn't it?
It is. I think several people have accused us of being estate whisperers, which I'll accept. One of the things that's different when an artist is not with us is that, you have 15 opinions from litigators and lawyers and trustees and executors and beneficiaries and their kids, and none of them really understand the business.
Right. Absolutely not. No.
No. And one of the things they're driven by is they understand that they've inherited this thing that's very gossamer and very valuable that cannot be recreated. And I think sometimes, they've seen every Hollywood movie of the past 50 years with the guy in the back room with the green visor and heard about all the stories of people losing their money and getting defrauded and ripped off. And sometimes they're paralyzed by fear.
The families of these people, the individuals who have passed on, are paralyzed by fear?
Yeah, well, sometimes they don't want to make the wrong move, or they're afraid, or they're not sure.
Right.
Which, by the way, is preferable to the other side of the coin, which is they are confident they can do this.
Right, exactly.
And they make moves which may further denigrate the legacy.
Absolutely. So many thoughts running through my mind talking to you about this. And the one that just popped in, and this isn't really, they're not dead, but they keep repackaging Beatles catalogs in I don't know how many different forms over the years. You know, if it was a 45 RPM record, then it was an album. Then it was like an 8-track. Then it was a cassette. Then it was a CD. Then it's remixed. Then it's remastered. Then there's outtakes. Then there's alternate versions. Then there's this. Then there's that. And you pay through the nose to get those goods if you want it.
That model not only drove the entire record business, but I remember sitting with the sitting chairman of a major label back in the mid-90s, and I asked him, I said, what you're really doing here is you've got one or two hits trapped in this CD that the consumer is forced to pay $20 for.
Right.
And what are you going to do when that model is broken? And he looked at me and he said, if that model's ever broken, our business is over.
Wow.
And I felt it was that the first step in it being broken was when CDs came out in 1980. And the first thing I noticed on a CD player is you could just push a button to listen to whichever track you wanted.
Exactly. Yeah. How do you start a business with these estates? I mean, do you go to them? Do they come to you? How are you? You don't hand out business cards on the street corner. How does this all come about? I mean,
one of the trade magazines, their nickname for me for a while was the Tomb Raider.
But that's not fair.
Of course it's not fair.
That's not fair at all. I mean, you're saving these people. You're saving the legacy of these artists.
Yeah, what happened was, is when Danny Sugarman and I first partnered up again to co-manage the Doors, this is in the late 90s, and I have a good friend of mine, Wayne Kramer, from the MC5, who has a couple really great quotes. And one of the things he always told me is he said, Jeff, unfortunately, self does not reveal self to self.
Man, I love the MC5. They're from my hometown.
There you go, Detroit boy.
Yeah.
And so I think what happened was, is that Danny and I were able to hold up very effective mirrors for each other. And when we applied our joint efforts, what happened was, because we were looking at it with fresh eyes, as if nothing had existed before, and the Doors business exploded. I mean, it scared me. I called Danny one day, and I said, Danny, it's a mistake. I think there's an extra zero on this check. And he's like, no, that's what it should be. And once I realized that this was working, and it was working long-term,
yes,
I sat down with him one night, and I said, Danny, if this works this well for the Doors, why would this not work for the Rolling Stones or Led Zeppelin or the Who or the Beach Boys or anybody?
Yeah.
And Danny just gave me this blank look. Like, you got to remember, Jim Morrison, like, took Danny under his wing as a 12-year-old and taught Danny what and how to read and to drink and smoke and get laid and... You know, Danny never really saw beyond that. And so I said to Danny, look, Janis Joplin, same wheelhouse, same ethos, same zeitgeist, same time period. Let me go talk to the Joplin estate. And he said, okay, great. And we started talking, and sadly, Danny actually passed away weeks before we signed the Joplin estate. Oh,
sorry to hear that.
Yeah. And once we took over the Joplin estate, the same exact thing happened, albeit on a smaller scale.
Right.
And then we had proven the model, and we have not gone after a client since then, and that's been 18 years.
And they come to you.
They have, and I'm really grateful for that.
Yes, well, you obviously have maintained a reputation of fairness and looking out for the interests of those who are connected to someone from their family who is no longer with them. If you don't do it, as you mentioned earlier, if the family thinks they can do it, they're really mistaken. And I'm sure that there are unscrupulous vultures hovering about, just ready to pounce down and try to grab somebody's catalog.
Nah, that would never happen. Yeah, I call it Jackson Pollock syndrome.
Yeah, because it just splattered everywhere?
No, it's because it's kind of like when you take a kid to see a Pollock drip painting at a museum, and you turn to the kid and go, you could do that.
Right, right.
And everybody thinks they can do it. And I know this because I had Jackson Pollock syndrome. And unfortunately, the chief symptom of Jackson Pollock syndrome is that you don't have a damn clue that you don't have a damn clue. And it's not that I was that smart or that cool. It's just I had a secret weapon. I had Danny Sugarman.
Yeah.
And Danny became what I call the thing between my gun and my foot. And he kept me from shooting myself in the foot about 300 times until the lights started to come on. And once they started to come on, then I started to really recognize what this business is. And then, again, once we started adding more and more clients, I would then have a data set that was more objective. It's not just the Doors. You know, it works for Janis Joplin or Tupac Shakur or Otis Redding or Muddy Waters or John Lee Hooker or the Ramones. And, you know, as I've told potential clients, I said, you know, I've survived the first 500 fatal errors. We're figuring out new ways to screw things up all the time, but we're starting at mistake 501.
You know, the thing that also enables the longevity of an artist is the advancement in technology. That if you go and take Buddy Holly record from the 1950s, and if you were to play the 45 on a record player, and then listen to what it sounds like now on, you know, Spotify or iTunes or whatever, it's like a brand new song.
I would actually disagree with you, John. I think it's the exact opposite. I think the original vinyl from back then sounds vastly superior to a compressed MP3 today.
But I'm saying, though, that if it wasn't for the MP3 or any of the streaming services, the ability for access to that particular type of music or anything else, you know, it wouldn't be there.
Well, that's true to an extent, John, but, you know, Barry Diller had a very famous quote in the 90s, and he said, content is king.
Oh, you bet.
And I hate the word content, by the way. There's two words that I forbid in my company from being used, and I have actually stopped meetings when people uttered them more than once.
What are they?
The two words, and I warn them, is content and exploit. And I have people coming in all the time, oh, we're going to exploit this content, it's going to be great. And it turns my stomach. And yeah. I tell them, you know, I don't think that Janis Joplin lived and died for content.
No.
And P.S., no. A lot of people tried to exploit my clients while they were alive. Why would I want to exploit them now? So why don't you try using the words art and utilize? And if you want to utilize some art, we can talk. And if you want to exploit content, then it's time to go.
Some artists who are currently with us, but are advanced in age, perhaps, and who weren't allowed to get out and perform during the pandemic, and maybe have decided that that's not a venue that they want to follow anymore, have decided to sell for astronomical amounts of money their entire catalog, plus the rights to their image and likeness and everything else.
Right.
And the people buying them, I'm guessing, are figuring that this is good for a long-term investment.
Correct. Yeah, there's several different factors at play if you want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I think the pandemic, you know, maybe accelerated things, but I don't think it was the cause. You know, what's happened is, first of all, Congress passed a law in the 70s that allows artists to recapture ownership of their copyrights after a period of time. It's colloquially known as the second bite at the apple law. But any artist who signed away his publishing and masters can file a claim to get them back in the United States after a certain period of time in certain windows. And so artists are getting their publishing back. And other artists have controlled it all along. And the way that publishing is valued is you look at what the publishing part of the copyright earns per year. And that's called the abbreviation we use is NPS, which stands for Net Publisher Share. So, for example, let's say that the publishing share of the copyrights brings in $1 million a year, just to make it, we'll make the math easy.
Okay.
And so publishing catalogs were always valued at a multiple of NPS. So if your NPS is $1 million a year, classically for about 15, 20, 25 years, the multiple was somewhere between 4 and 8 times.
Wow.
So it was worth between $4 and $8 million.
Wow.
And then for a period, it went up. It went up to 10 and 12 and 14. And then it came back down to like between 8 and 10. And then what happened is, because the economy has been soaring and because interest rates have been so low, a ton of money, billions and billions of dollars, have poured into the marketplace, and they're looking for good long-term investments. And you know who really drove that was pension funds.
Yeah. Listen, I have to wrap this up, unfortunately, because of the time limit, but I got to tell you, Jeff, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation, and thank you so much for being with us. And maybe someday we can talk again, because what you're doing is, you know, a public service for all of us.